Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website www.thecritic.co.uk to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this edition, Professor Jeremy Black, author of Waterloo and France, A Short History, talks to The Critic's deputy editor Graham Stewart about the shifting reputation of Napoleon Bonaparte.
Professor Jeremy Black, in talking about Napoleon's reputation, we should perhaps start with what his reputation was at the time, not just amongst those who were his enemies, but those in France itself, particularly those who were not part of his dream, not part of his vision, monarchists and other opponents of his regime. How divided was Napoleonic France in its attitude to Napoleon during his years of victories and in the period of his defeat?
France was quite divided, but it was very difficult for people to show their views on the matter because it was an authoritarian state. A fair number of royalists, in addition, had gone into exile, as had a certain number of Republicans. I think it's fair to say that we simply don't know. There is no equivalent of public opinion polls in that period. We know that the elections, there's a very good book on this by Irene Collins, the elections held under Napoleon were sort of North Korean in their integrity. And Napoleon never put himself to a democratic mandate, however restricted this might have been. So it was a military regime, and people could only respond by either complying or by doing what a lot of them did, which is going in for low-level non-compliance. Although in some cases there was quite high-level non-compliance in the sense of growing numbers of people who sought to evade conscription.
You've written about Napoleon being the man was a thug with pretensions and his empire system of expropriation. The Bourbons wouldn't be said to have had pretensions. They were the absolute monarchy. But how different was their empire in its system of expropriation from that run by Napoleon?
Well, I mean, the Bourbons were not absolute monarchs. I mean, I think, you know, that's the first thing. There was a system, we might not agree with it, but there was a system of responsibility to the law, whether the law was expressed through Parliament or other forms of provincial autonomy. And in many senses, Napoleon was more powerful than his Bourbon predecessors, not least, in fact, in enforcing conscription. As far as empire was concerned, obviously France had an overseas empire, although that would have been, some of the most important parts of that had been lost in war with Britain. But one of the interesting aspects under Louis XV and Louis XVI of France's attitudes towards its neighbours was that it had tried to settle border disputes in a conciliatory fashion. And in fact, if you look at France's last two territorial acquisitions under the Ancien Régime in Europe, Corsica had been bought from its owners, the Republic of Genoa, in 1768, and Lorraine, the Duchy of Lorraine, which came into the French royal patrimony in 1766, did so as a result of a treaty in the 1730s. So France had not, under the Ancien Régime, been, as it were, an expansionist, or if to use the term, state. I think the interesting contrast would be, if one wanted to draw it, between Napoleon and the Republic. Many of the criticisms that are mooted against Napoleon could also be mooted against the Republican regimes that are in power from 1792 onwards. I mean, Napoleon rises to power as a Republican general who then seizes power from the Republic. And indeed, the contrast, as it were, between, which is sometimes drawn, as you were drawing it in your question, between Napoleon and the Bourbons is, as it were, to a degree, malpose, because the Bourbons had already gone. I mean, France was a republic from 1792. Louis XVI had been executed in 1793. Louis XVII had died in prison. Louis XVIII, the Comte de Provence, was in exile. So the French monarchy had gone. What Napoleon does, which is one of the reasons that a lot of people at the time, though we don't know how many, feel that they cannot forgive him for, was he destroys the Republic. I mean, in a way, and all analogies across time are difficult, he's the Stalin of the Russian Revolution. And although I think Lenin, in a way, was a precursor of the Stalin, I mean, and in a way, that angered some, and a certain number of Republicans, of course, went off to serve for other armies. So I think if you want to criticize Napoleon, you should, or to judge him, you should judge him in terms of the Republic which he overthrew, rather than the Bourbons who'd already been overthrown. And indeed, in looking at the question of how President Macron considered Napoleon, he set up, I mean, I thought he was in a difficult position, and it's not his job to teach us history seminar, as it were. But he set up, when he said that Napoleon shouldn't be judged by modern standards, and he was referring here to Napoleon's reintroduction of slavery, he set up the modern as an anachronism against the past as the best criteria for judging Napoleon, which he was perfectly free to do. But of course, what he ignored is that there were a number of judgments, as your first question correctly implied, a number of judgments from which Napoleon could be considered.
And in France today, is Napoleon seen perhaps paradoxically as a saviour of republican virtues and republican values, even though he was the emperor who replaced the republic?
Well, I think that's again a fascinating question. I think it's fair to say that France is, as you would expect, a country which, as you know, is a mature democracy, you might say, has a number of views not only on the present but also on the past. And you might say that although what we're seeing at the moment is the contesting of a national account, the sort of process we also see in Britain, but another way to look at it is to say that some of the national account was always rather unwarranted. But if you go back, of course, one has to be aware that in the 19th century, Napoleon was a highly contentious figure. After all, he was the person that had destroyed the First Republic. His nephew, Louis Napoleon, subsequently Napoleon III, destroys the Second Republic, bringing in the Second Empire in 1852. That is brought down by the Prussians in the Franco-Prussian War in 1870 and is replaced by the Third Republic. Now, neither the Second nor the Third Republic had any particular reason to love Napoleon. What I think you've got, obviously, it varied by individuals. So radicals opposed to Napoleon III, such as Victor Hugo, who spent Napoleon III's reign in exile, could still possibly present Napoleon I in a positive light. And Victor Hugo does in his novel Les Misérables in 1862, in which Napoleon comes across as a man of destiny and soul. But there were other figures from that Republican tradition who were very worried about the idea of a proconsul on horseback seizing power. They were worried, for example, about General Boulanger under the Third Republic. And indeed, if you take that further on, you can see that in the Fourth and Fifth Republics, with the concern about the reputation of General Pétain and subsequently with critics of General de Gaulle. Both of those found it, to put it mildly, irritating to face some of these Republican criticisms. They saw themselves as figures who were had not gone as far as the first emperor, but others didn't take that view. And I can recall being in Paris and looking at depictions of President Sarkozy as if he was Napoleon in a David painting crossing the Alps. And that was, I think, ridiculous, but nevertheless captured this sense among Republicans, particularly Republicans on the left, that there was something illegitimate about Napoleon and about the whole practice of military power in that fashion.
Is there, I wonder, also something in French discourse about the nature of Napoleon as the great man against which all other subsequent politicians cannot match up to in terms of grandeur of vision and sheer power and will to power?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, will to power, which is something the Romantics admired, or some of them admired, was of course what led Bertrand Russell to describe Hitler as the last Romantic. I'm not sure that we would necessarily applaud will to power. I mean, Saddam Hussein had a will to power. You, on that basis, attacked neighbours and brutalised people. Now, I'm not implying that Napoleon was a man as boorish as Saddam Hussein, but I do think you shouldn't necessarily worship a will to power. I mean, the standard account of criminal masterminds emphasizes gang leaders, emphasizes their will to power. So no, I don't think that that in any way justifies the situation. The other thing that is worth bearing in mind is the directory government, which Napoleon overthrew in late 1799, had turned the corner on the Second Coalition. The Second Coalition of France's opponents was falling to pieces. Russia under Tsar Paul was defecting from its allies because it was disenchanted. You don't need to say that Napoleon had to seize power for the Republic to survive. Now, it may well be the case that you could argue that Napoleon's military victories enabled France to dominate Central Europe in 1805, 1806, 1807, and then subsequently to move into Eastern Europe. But obviously that those provided only a short-term panacea. And I think it is fair to say that the Napoleon's success was highly ephemeral. And again, one thinks there of the comparison with Adolf Hitler. It wasn't just that it was a will to power, which I think was baleful in itself. It was an unsuccessful will to power, which is even more bizarre as a reason for praising him.
Other than obviously Louis Napoleon, Napoleon III, who do you see as the European figures who modelled themselves most closely by, were most inspired by Napoleon?
Well, I think Napoleon was most inspiring, not for European figures so much, but for Latin American caudillos. That in a way, when you have a system of no legitimacy of power, because it is a new state that you've created, as in the republics that followed the Spanish Empire, then those people who wish to use force to seize power have to find some sort of interpretation to justify it. So a figure like Santa Anna in Mexico would be a good example. I mean, the attractive feature of the history of the United States is that although there were one or two generals who did clearly have interests in breaking the Constitution, James Wilkinson is the best example. The Americans on the whole followed a principle that generals or ex-generals should only come to power through constitutional means, as with Andrew Jackson or Harrison, for example. But I think that Napoleon offers an opportunity for all rulers who are, or all would-be rulers, who have no legitimate basis for power, no base either in terms of hereditary or the mandate of the population or the mandate of a limited portion of the population through some electoral system. He offers a way to justify themselves. Now, I personally don't think that's a terribly desirable imprint, and I'm glad to say that the French subsequently have largely managed to pass that by.
And what are the analogies that historians draw between Napoleon and Hitler?
Well, some historians vary. You have historians that praise Napoleon, and if you wanted a historian who's written an influential account which is praising Napoleon, you can think of Andrew Roberts. I think it's fair to say that other historians have been less sympathetic to Napoleon. And I think what's interesting is the general direction of British historians writing about Napoleon in recent decades, I would say, has been to emphasize his flaws and his limitations, which is exactly what you would expect. I mean, here was a man who gained power through the use of force, who clearly loved the panoply of power and being surrounded by the excitement and personnel of war, who created a pseudo-aristocracy with their lands and their titles, which is very reminiscent of Hitler, of course, and who ultimately failed and caused his own country massive casualties. What is interesting in my mind, and you can see this in one of the books by Tim Blanning, is when he went on to compare the debates in the French National Assembly in the 1790s and what he saw, I think with reason, as the sort of degree of hysteria in some of those in the early 1790s. He compared those again with modern, more radical, shall we say, forums. And I think the point is that both the French Revolution and Napoleon have served modern commentators as a frame of reference through which and with which to debate the past. And I think that what that does is picture the extent to which it has a resonance today. Nobody today, after all, in France, we wouldn't be sitting down and talking about the Fronde or the French Wars of Religion, even though these were very violent episodes, particularly the Wars of Religion, but also the Fronde. These were very violent episodes in France, which raised fundamental questions about the best way of conducting politics. And indeed, in the French Wars of Religion led to the killing of two successive French kings, Henry III in 1589 and Henry IV in 1610. But in a way that appears the past, that appears to be totally redundant. What is interesting is that people have been able to resonate with or to pillage, depending upon your point of view, aspects of the past. Now, if one wants to be critical of that, one can say that sometimes this lacks a three-dimensionality. So you could say that the mention of Napoleon reintroducing slavery tells us more about, as President Macron was implying, the situation today than it really does about the ways of looking at things in the early 1800s. On the other hand, for contemporaries and for commentators today, whom were, shall we say, for want of a better term, on the left, what this represented was an aspect of a conservatism seen with Napoleon, also seen, for example, with the Concordat with the papacy, in which Napoleon is, as it were, not a progressive figure, which is one of the reasons why this is focused on, but in fact, in some respects, insofar as you wish to see history as unidimensional or unidirectional, which I do not wish to see, a regressive figure. I would prefer to say that Napoleon was in part casting around for constituencies of support, in part was genuinely a racist and didn't like black people, although he didn't really know them. And in, you know, this may be linked to, of course, you know, his Josephine's background. You can make a number of suggestions. All I think it does is help to create a more interesting complexity in considering the figure. And, you know, one of the purposes of drawing comparisons with Hitler is not to say that Napoleon was necessarily like Hitler. I mean, after all, Hitler never had battlefield command of an army and simply wouldn't have been up to it, etc., etc. There were differences between the men. Napoleon worked extremely hard. Hitler was fundamentally lazy. Napoleon had more intellectual and literary interests than Hitler, etc., etc. So there are obviously very significant differences between them. But the Napoleon didn't have, obviously, Hitler's anti-Semitism. But I think that the reason one is making that point is simply to get people to think, because all too often they come away or come over with a very sort of crude account, often very crude praising account, as you've just suggested when you mentioned about the triumph of the will, as it were, without thinking about the broader implications of the comparisons that could be made.
Is there a dichotomy in terms of how historians see Napoleon as a ruler, the policies and diplomacy he pursued in his style of government, and Napoleon the general? Or is it usually the case that historians who are critical of Napoleon, the man and the politician, also find fault with him as a general?
Oh, again, that's a fascinating question. Well, I would say, and all I've got is my impression. I mean, I know some people, but I don't know everybody, of course. My impression is that much of the discussion of Napoleon as a general takes place in a separate, as it were, field of debate, the debate field of military history. And there, a lot of the attention is given to Napoleon as an operational level commander. The Americans sometimes call that strategy, but that's because they don't understand the distinction between tactics, operational level and strategic level of war. So it's really operational level. And that's where Napoleon is generally praised. And the praise for him can be absolutely unrelated to any sense of his quality or otherwise as a ruler. I think it's fair to say that if you're interested as Napoleon as a strategist, as understood, in my view, how strategy ought to be understood, the Americans might call that grand strategy, then clearly Napoleon's inability to grasp adequately the nature of limits, his inability to create a successful constituency of support for his new order, that matches both in grand strategic terms that you might call military, but it also matches a perception of his political system. So I would say that Napoleon, in my view, should be seen as a failure as a strategist, but as a success as an operational commander. And I would say that's not too complex a view. I would say some military historians would agree with me. Others just prefer to focus on the operational side. And I wouldn't say that the latter are necessarily pro or anti Napoleon as a ruler. They might, in fact, regard that as a slightly irrelevant criteria. In other words, you know, if you're looking at World War II, on which, as you know, I've published, you can discuss the success of breakthrough activities and operational level warfare in 1944-45 without feeling any praise at all for Joseph Stalin or for the system over which he presided.
Is there, turning to the 100 Days campaign, is there any kind of historian's consensus about whether Napoleon really fought the best campaign he could in the circumstances in which he found himself, or, you know, that he was let down by tactical decisions, supposedly being, you know, not feeling well on the day of Waterloo, nay, charging forward without proper support, and so on? Or is there a feeling, actually, that Napoleon, Grouchy turning up late, is there a sense that actually Napoleon played that campaign as well as he could with the resources he had?
Well, again, an excellent question. No, there is generally a consensus that Napoleon handled it very badly. If you're looking at the day of Waterloo on June the 18th, well, let's go through it. I mean, you know, I've written a book on Napoleon. I've written quite extensively on strategies. I mean, it's a good question. You forced me to try and summarize. And of course, that's always a great discipline for a historian. Right. On June the 16th, when he attacked the Prussians at Ligny, he was not able to, he bashed the Prussians quite heavily, but he wasn't able to destroy their army or to direct their axis of retreat. Also, by moving troops backwards and forwards between Ligny and Quatre Bras, where the French were fighting the British, he ensured that some of his army wasn't applied in either cases. On June the 17th, he failed to maintain contact with the Prussians and failed, whilst the British were retreating, to, as it were, inflict any significant damage to them. On June the 18th, he failed to envelop Wellington's position. He didn't work round Wellington's right, the French left. He failed to make due preparation against the possibility of Prussian troops feeding in onto the British left, his right. He actually ended up with a series of batter attacks, rather as at Borodino against the Russians in 1812, which was rather crude. And he lost control of the battle. And I would say, I mean, you know, you can take different points of view if you like, that he showed himself well below the level that Wellington was showing. But I would also say his entire strategic background for the 1815 operation was deeply flawed. I mean, I think I'm right in saying that Paul Schrader, I can't remember the quote, my memory is not as good as it used to be, but Paul Schrader, in his great book on European international relations from Europe's transformation, described him as some kind of crook who was throwing the dice. I mean, And I mean, he was throwing the dice in a distinctly skewed fashion. He had no real defeats on his opponents that somehow the British would defeated, would overthrow the government, and that, you know, a government of Whigs would come in that would negotiate with him, that if he defeated the Prussians would abandon the alliance as they'd abandoned the first coalition in 1795. And that then, you know, he could deal with the Austrians and the Russians. This was all cloud cuckoo land stuff. I mean, the opponents were vastly superior, not just in numbers, but actually in fighting qualities and command skills. Some of the best French generals weren't willing to stand by him in 1815. And he was in a delusional fashion. And you can see this delusion continuing after Waterloo, when he imagines he can create a new army, assemble it at Laon, and, you know, completely ignores the situation on the ground. So I am very unimpressed by Napoleon. I've written a book on strategy, which has not yet been published, on strategy in the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, and I am very unimpressed by him. And I think that you really do need a combination of tactical, operational, and strategic success. If you want to look at a more attractive comparison, and I can understand that people find the comparison with Hitler, some people find that offensive, though, I mean, I can't see why. If you want another comparison of somebody who could be good as a battlefield commander, but lacked the strategic understanding of the situation, that's Hannibal in the Second Punic War. I mean, there are many other generals we can think of, again, a similar kind of scenario. And of course, ends up going down in failure. And unable to protect his home base in Carthage. So I think that the Napoleon, in some respects, to my mind, and, you know, I accept that there are other points of view, but in my mind, is a strategically very flawed individual. Now, the reason I suggested we have this conversation was I was interested in President Macron's dilemma, if you like, as to whether to acknowledge the anniversary with Napoleon and how to acknowledge it. And, you know, President Macron is a clever man, and the obvious way, if you're going to acknowledge it, is to define the, as it were, the debating chamber in terms of divine the debate between, you know, you're either me or you go around butchering babies at dawn kind of stuff, which is, in other words, to imply that that there is a clear answer. And of course, what he did was he argued that the critics of Napoleon, and here he was fundamentally responding to the very immediate situation of what to the French is the borrowing of Anglo-American, what we would call wokeism, but what they call Anglo-American sort of values, in applying an element of the present in order to castigate the past. And also, of course, President Macron is looking very much at the need to protect the reputation of France in terms of a challenge which he feels he is facing by Marine Le Pen, who is likely to wrap herself in the flag. So you can see where Macron is coming from. And what I think is interesting about that, and it exemplifies, as you know, I just brought out a history of France, it exemplifies what you would see in France very clearly, which is judgments of the past are very much written in terms of the politics of the present. Nothing terribly wrong with that. It's actually what generally happens. It doesn't mean that those are the only values on offer, and it doesn't mean that academics are necessarily matching the desiderata of politicians. But it's worth thinking about that element, because, of course, we can see aspects of that in today. I thought Macron's defense of Napoleon against the wokishness of some of the criticism, and I am not a fan of Napoleon, I hope I've made that fairly clear, but I think that Macron's defense of Napoleon was something that, you know, it wouldn't hurt some British politicians to think about trying to defend some figures from the British past against ahistorical and flawed analyses.
It still seems a more nuanced defence by Macron of the need and the importance to commemorate the bicentenary than it did in 1989 with President François Mitterrand commemorating the fall of the Bastille, which certainly from memory, I think, you know, the celebrations, European leaders were summoned to Paris, and there was a real sense that the French Revolution was this tremendous gift to mankind, and no debate about it. In that sense, there seems to be a slightly more nuanced, more subtle attitude that Mitterrand brought to the state-approved version of French greatness.
Oh, yes, I agree with you entirely. In fact, the French had I think it was 300, 200, I think it was 200, I can't remember, historians were invited to Paris, fair paid, looked after, etc. They had four from Britain. I was fortunate enough to be one of the four. And we were addressed by the president, which was, to my mind, absolutely hilarious. I mean, we were all expected to stand. And the president came in looking like what I would imagine a reincarnation of Louis XIV in his grandeur. And he sort of looked at us, and then he sort of walked to a podium where some flunky in uniform produced a speech. And he read out exactly as you said, a sort of thing of the revolution was of the world and for the world and all the rest of it. And it was, you know, very much intended. It was marvelous of all these French people in the past to reflect glory on President Mitterrand, which is very much the attitude. Well, Mitterrand, of course, was a great poseur, and a poseur as an intellectual, a great poseur, a man who was sort of a very devious and unpleasant individual. I mean, you know, the phrase, the French Sphinx, I mean, I think that's a nice way of putting an alternative to your will to power earlier on. I think Macron is somebody who has more integrity than Mitterrand. I mean, that wouldn't be very difficult, but I think he has more integrity than Mitterrand and more intelligence. And also that the Mitterrand is a member of the Socialist Party. What he was trying to do was annex the French Revolution to the cause of the modern Socialist Party. Now, and in other words, he was doing the classic thing you'd seen under the Third Republic of looking back to the revolution for its validation. Now, Macron's had a different task, a much harder task, because Napoleon for the French is a harder figure to defend than the revolutionaries. The revolutionaries can be presented as people that modernized France, went wrong with the terror, self-righted, and created a sort of, you know, a more humane society. I mean, obviously, that's a caricature given what the brutality that revolutionary forces enforced on French opponents, you know, which wasn't just the terror, including, incidentally, Napoleon, who was, quite willing to, have men and women shot down if it suited the French Republican cause, let alone what he subsequently did as emperor. But Macron's task is hard. It would have been interesting to see how Mitterrand would have presented Napoleon had he been alive this year. Mitterrand, that is, Napoleon. But the Macron, in my view, handled his task, which would always have been harder, with more skill. I mean, Mitterrand was the sort of man that always went, for easy targets or just avoided the challenge. And I think it was a very easy target, the idea of annex the revolution to the cause of modern France and say that it represents the modern world and overlook the problems that it caused. Now, ironically, of course, very ironically, this was the summer of 1989. And I still think, looking back on that year at the end of 1989, it was absolutely hilarious, because Mitterrand's justification of the revolution and its violence and its disruption was very similar to the justification that pro-communist intellectuals used to justify the totalitarian systems that communism had led to in Eastern Europe. And indeed, in the case of British left-wing historians, the kind of order they would have liked to impose in Britain itself. Now, obviously, in 1989, this was a big hole was to be blown in this interpretation in Eastern Europe. No similar hole was burnt or blasted in the interpretation of French history. The interesting thing is, many French people resisted the revolution, not just aristocratic émigrés of a Scarlet Pimpernel type, but many French people resisted. And, you know, obviously the Vendée and the Chouans are famous, but also, for example, the Federalists in, you know, cities like Lyon, Marseille. And their account, their view of French history was, as it were, trashed by Mitterrand. And to my mind, that is the great problem of having a unitary account like that, particularly when it's a tendentious account, which is that, you know, you in effect can't make the omelette of modernity without breaking the eggs. And I think that that is a dangerous view of history. I think it was a view that was used by many apologists. I had a colleague who I can recall giving his inaugural, justifying Stalin of all people. I think the situation is that you really have to understand the complexities. So in the case of Napoleon, I would put it to you that alongside the benign account of Napoleon as a kind of moderniser who moves Europe, particularly Western Europe, towards a more liberal direction, comes the reality of a man who not only was a warlord who was responsible for the death and devastation of many, but also a man who destroyed the republic he destroyed the republic that had created him, but could not sustain the empire that he had put in its place. Now, to my mind, that you referred in effect to the triumph of the will at the outset. I don't like the term triumph in history. Let us just simply say that your notion of the triumph of the will comes up against my idea that if he was so impressive, he would have been able to sustain and achieve more. And therefore, I know people don't like comparisons, so let us add Hannibal to Hitler. But Hannibal, Hitler, and Napoleon, although they were different as men, Hannibal was probably the most talented as a general, although they were different as men, nevertheless, all of them failed to understand the situation they were in and brought down many other people with themselves in their baleful failure.
Well, that's a good point to leave the discussion. Professor Jeremy Black, whose many books on the subject include A History of France, thank you very much indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.